c'est parfait. Il est 5 heures, je pense qu'on va commencer. Bienvenue tout le monde, welcome to this general admissions information session, admission to the BCLLB program. My name is Ali Martin-Mayer and I'm the Assistant Dean in charge of admissions and recruitment at the Faculty of Law. It's a pleasure to welcome you and a good number, a good turnout tonight. We will be spending the next hour and a half together, and I hope to be able to answer as many of your questions as possible. Also with us today are Kelly Cassidy, who's the admissions officer. So at any point in time, if you want to ask a private question to her during the session or at the end of the session, when we will be fielding individual questions, you can ask them either to me or Kelly. And we also have two student ambassadors. I have only one up here, but we have a new addition. Ali and Janelle will be speaking to you as well, giving you their perspective as a former applicant and currently a McGill Law student. You have received two yellow documents. One is a feedback survey that we would really appreciate for you to fill out and return to us before you leave so that we can keep improving this session, as well as a little flashcard for questions. This session is being filmed and we will be webcasting it afterwards to make it available to anyone who wasn't able to be here today. So the way it will work for the questions is that we will take them on paper so that I can sort through, read them out loud, and then answer them. So also because it is webcast, I want to make sure I get through all of the information in a certain order, and we will keep the questions until the end, with the exception of the questions for the students that you can ask right after their presentation. The session will be bilingual, as the faculty is, so there will be a mix of English and French. And so I'm off with English right now. I just wanted to know who here is currently in CJEP looking to apply. Good number. Who's in university near graduation looking to apply? Anyone out of school for a bit? Great. Anyone with a prior law degree? Okay. That's great. Anyone from out of town? A few. Thank you for coming this far. Okay, that gives me a good sense of the type of questions we might be getting. I will touch on the information I'll be providing will, you know, be applicable to all your different scenarios, either as a CJEP or a university or a mature applicant or an advanced standing applicant in some cases. Oh, who here went on the tour? Oh, a few people. This year we tried we succeeded in offering faculty tours to anyone who wanted to do so right before the session. So the agenda for today will be, first for about 15 minutes, I'll be introducing the faculty and the program. Then we will have the student ambassadors' testimonials. And then we will get into the admissions, kind of nitty-gritty part of the session, so admissions policy, understanding what we're looking for, and then how the process runs and what you need to be putting together, and then we will have the Q&A. Regarding the Q&A, when I get your flashcards, I will try to answer the questions of general interest first, because I think it's more interesting for the rest, and then if we have time, I can publicly answer those that are more relevant to specific cases, but if there are some that are that you just want to ask individually, you can stay at the end and you can take a few extra minutes. Alors, so the program, I'll ask the question, but how many people have already gone through our website in more or less detail? Yeah, that's what I thought. So some of it might be a little bit redundant. I do try to add, obviously, value to this session as much as possible. So the program we have here, well, the Faculty of Law is the oldest law faculty in the country. It has a lot of history. You can see here in the room all the black and white pictures are those of Supreme Court justices who came from McGill Law. So there's a rich heritage in legal education and then going on in the legal community. The program that you are interested in applying to is an integrated civil law, common law program that started back in 1999. So we've had quite a few generations of students who have, the first might have been guinea pigs. It was a real innovative approach to teaching the law when it started, and it actually still is. And so we've had many generations of students be able to prove that our formula really works. So the way we teach the law is some of the courses have civil law and common law traditions being discussed in the same course. Beyond that, it's just a mindset that infuses the entire curriculum. So if you're wondering what that means really, and I don't want to get into too much of the details because you might know already and you might be here more for admissions things than hearing about how innovative our program is, but you understand the fundamental concepts of both legal traditions. But beyond that, you're looking at law as a social phenomenon kind of outside of either traditions, focusing more on issues and problems that arise in society that need legal answers, and then you will look at it from different lenses. So it makes you be quite nimble. It's quite an intellectual challenge, I would think, the first year, and maybe the students will speak about that a little bit. But at the end, you come out with a lot of adaptable skill sets to be able to be a jurist in different jurisdictions, speaking different languages, and it opens a lot of doors to traditional and non-traditional careers. And in pragmatic terms, you do graduate with two law degrees that you can obtain as quickly as 3 years. So it's a really good bang for your buck, I guess. For those, I don't know how many are familiar with this, but so the BCL stands for Bachelor of Civil Law, and the LLB stands for the Common Law Degree, which is the equivalent to what is used as the term used elsewhere outside of Quebec as a JD. Okay, a little bit more information about the program and the different options that exist. So the program itself is 105 credits. So it is 15 more credits than your traditional law program elsewhere in other law faculties. But for those extra 15 credits, you will get a second law degree. The traditional speed of completion is 3.5 years, but you can accelerate it to 3 years or take a bit more time and do it in 4 years. It's easier if you do it in 4 years to go on an exchange or do year-long activities that you might really want to take advantage of while you're here. You can choose to do more than the base program, and so there are different options to kind of personalize your program to the extent that we have these offerings. One way is to do a major, and there are two large families of major, the Commercial Negotiation and Dispute Resolution major and the International Human Rights and Development major. So it requires you to take 18 more credits, and those credits, the major is composed of a number of courses in law relating to that big family, well, that big area of interest, as well as non-law courses that would have a good cross-disciplinary angle to them that complement the legal education you would get in that field, as well as an internship with an organization or a company that we can help you find.
in those areas as well as a term essay. So it's and that is something that would show up on your transcripts. So if you are interested in demonstrating or exploring an interest further in a really concrete way, you can choose to do a major. By the way, you don't have to choose any of this at the stage of admission. You can think about it or mention it if you're interested, but you can always sign on once you're a law student. Something else you can do that's also quite popular with CEGEP students, well, students coming directly from CEGEP, is to do a minor. You can do any minor that the Faculty of Arts or Science offers, and that will range between 18 and 24 credits. So let's say you're interested in art history, but, I mean, you wanted law more, but you chose to go into art history. You chose law but wanted to explore that. You can do so kind of underside of your law degree. Of course, it will cross-pollinate into your mind, and then you can think of all kinds of creative ways to reinvent what the contours of law are. So that's another option. A third option is also an additional load, is to do an honors program, which is really more for the academically inclined who want to do a major research paper with a professor throughout their time. There's a minimum GPA requirement. That is something you can explore later on. In addition to this, or you can do only that. I'm happy today we have a student ambassador who is in one of our joint programs. So we have joint programs, partnerships with the Des Hôtels Faculty of Management for you to do a law and an MBA, as well as a law or, well, that's with the School of Social Work, a law and a master in social work. You have to apply to both, be admitted, and the admission processes are independent for both. If you get admitted to law but not the other one, you still have your spot in the law program. And I mean, there are a few parameters because it's a master's program. CEGEP applicants would not be eligible for those programs. Again, you can think about it and start, or you know, go through the application process for the master's after you've started law school. Oh, and if you have, I'm kind of talking for the other school, but for the Master's of Social Work, typically it's for someone who has a Bachelor's of Social Work, although there is a way to do a qualifying year if you don't have that, but you're still interested in it. But that's kind of there for them to explain. This is a very charged, heavy slide. You don't have to remember or really read through it in too much detail, but it's just in one view what the program looks like. So almost all of the first year courses are the same for everyone, and you kind of feel like you're back in high school because you don't really have a choice as to the courses you're taking. There are some required courses in second year that you need to take in second year. Then there are a number of courses you need to take at some point. You need to write an essay at some point. That's the writing requirement. Typical to McGill is the complementary human rights and social diversity basket that you need to take at least one course in. And then you have elective courses, so typically upper year courses that you would choose. And then there is a lot of, well, for what we have to cover in 105 credits for you to get the two degrees, the faculty has still managed to leave quite a bit of room for you to do other things than transsystemic law courses. So you can take some courses outside of the faculty, either in law or not in law. So if another university offers a course in law that you really want to take, and you can make that case and take it there, you can take non-law courses at McGill or elsewhere. And then there is a certain allotment of courses you can do outside of the faculty if you go on exchange, etc. What is even more fun, well, no, also fun, is the possibility of doing non-course credits. So that means getting credits for doing all these great practical, experiential learning things that you can do. And so here we have a list of some of these things. So competitive mooting, group assistance, legal methodology teaching groups. So that's kind of you being the helper of the teacher in teaching a course. Here are the faculty. You can do international human rights internships for credits. You can do clerkships, in-course clerkships for credits, work at a legal clinic, work for one of the journals, etc. So if you ever hear that McGill is very theoretical, there is some of that, I'm sure, but hand in hand with it are tons of opportunities for you to apply what you learn in the real world, I guess, I would say. And on top of that, our students are very dynamic to start with, and I'm sure you'll get that from our ambassadors, but they want to do things even though they won't get paid or get credit for it. So there are a lot of other things happening on campus and outside of campus that are going to contribute to your learning experience. So here I've just listed some of them. The Legal Information Clinic is one of them. Our high school outreach program, LEX, it's called LEX, is also another. There are a lot of very vibrant, like kind of advocate student groups as well. And then there are like a whole slew of social activities that I'm too far removed from law school to remember or want to mention here, but they're a lot of fun. Something else the faculty offers, we're lucky to have at the faculty, not only do we do our own admissions, but we have our own student affairs office with student services, including a very active career development office. So in our day and age anyway, all law schools have that, but ours is very active and very active in trying to find with you what you want to do and then find with you opportunities that are outside of what you would think are the traditional career paths. So they organize all kinds of recruitments. They keep databases of all these places where our alumni have gone, where we could kind of use our network to help you find opportunities. You know, our graduates would go into a legal practice, either in the private sector or the public sector. International work is also quite a good fit with the type of program we offer. In terms of geographic, if you want a geographic picture of where our graduates go, a bit more than 50% of them stay in the Montreal area, which is probably not that high compared to, I mean, law schools tend to be quite domestic in that sense. I think we're probably the least domestic. Our second biggest market in terms of right after law school jobs is Toronto, Ottawa, Ottawa for, I think, obvious reasons. You're very well equipped to work in a bilingual kind of federal public service type of setting. And then the kind of New York, Boston area is our fourth geographical market. What's interesting, and I didn't put it here, is that so our student body comes from all over Canada and some international students. They come here right after graduation. 90% of them will go to those four geographical markets. You know, most people want to kind of sit down and do the bar somewhere that's kind of easily accessible. But when you look 5 and 10 years out of graduation, it's up to 30% of that graduating class that is not in those four markets. So they come from far, they come here, study here, and good numbers stay around, and then they go back into the world. So I think it's kind of cool. The Career Development Office organizes all kinds of activities to help you, career days, networking opportunities on campus, recruitment, mentoring events, workshop readiness type of, workforce readiness, type of workshop, one-on-one advising, and they really stay with you until the end or even after you've graduated to help you as much as they can for you to land that opportunity that you want. And they support also a number of student initiatives that happen at the faculty. There are a lot of those. Okay, I'm just going to check for time. I think I'm being quite detailed in my explanations. Okay, so here I have just one example, and I'll go through it quickly, of the depth of the McGill network in terms of helping you find experiential learning opportunities, just clerkships. There are two types of clerkships, the ones you would do for credit while you're a student here, and then the type of clerkship you would do after you graduate that can be used as an articling opportunity. So we listed here the courts that have consistently, and certainly up until last year, hired for credits in one case and hired for money on the other, some are graduates. So it goes anywhere from, well, obviously the in-course ones have to be local because you have to go there physically one day a week, and then the graduation ones are both national and international. And then I listed some of the benefits of that type of experience. And if you don't know, from one year to another, we've been really lucky to have a very high number of our graduates go to clerk at the Supreme Court of Canada, which is the ultimate privilege for a law student. So we like to talk about that. And then another example of something that shows the breadth of our network internationally are our international human rights internship program, and these are the organizations that took students last year. So it's fine print, I know, but it looks like a nice traveling itinerary, although you would go to only one yourself. Okay, so I think I'm done with the broad stroke explanation of who we are, and I will give the floor to our two student ambassadors. Janelle, thank you.
Taller than me, so. So, hello everybody. It's really nice to see so many people here tonight, and I definitely remember a couple of years ago being in your shoes, and it's stressful and exciting, so I'm happy to be able to talk a bit about my experience. J'ai fait mon baccalauréat à l'Université de Queen's à Kingston. J'ai fait des études dans la science politique et économique avant mes études ici à McGill. Mais je suis née à Ottawa, alors j'avais cet aspect bilingue avant que je sois venue ici. Et j'ai travaillé beaucoup à Ottawa sur la colline parlementaire, alors comme guide parlementaire. J'ai fait un stage parlementaire aussi, et là j'ai retourné pour travailler pour le chef en chambre du Parti libéral. Alors, mon intérêt était pour les institutions, les procédures, c'était beaucoup de ce que j'ai écrit dans mon personal statement, comme je vais dire plus tard. So in terms of why law, which is something you'll talk about in your personal statement, I'm sure you've been grappling, why law, why McGill? Those are two big questions. So as I said, I was really interested in procedures and processes and institutions by virtue of my undergrad. And I found that a lot of the time, the way my classes would approach that would be very black and white. Like, it's either this or that, this or that. And as I'm sure you all know, that's often not the case. It's often a lot about relationships between people, and it's a lot more nuanced. And I realized that the law is a really good way to kind of look at those relationships. And McGill in particular has a really special way of looking at relationships and a really special way of talking about nuances and gray areas. An aspect of that is we're a bilingual faculty, so there's that cultural dimension already, which makes things pretty, it's a pretty unique way to study. And also is the civil and common law dimension. So you're always looking at things from two perspectives, and that's really interesting and useful, I found, in trying to answer some of those questions that motivated me to want to come to law school. So in terms of a personal statement, which is obviously quite a big and stressful part of applying to law school, I remember when I wrote mine, I remember showing it to my mom, and I was like, Mom, I think this is like the one. And she read it over breakfast, and she's like, yeah, no, I don't like it. I was like, good, helpful, thank you, Mom. Most stressful time of my life, and you're telling me I'm not doing a good job, so thank you. But in the end, it worked out. And I think what it was that I tried to find a really creative way to construct a narrative about the things I was interested in and why I thought I might have a unique perspective to bring to McGill and what I wanted to get back from McGill in return. So how I went about my personal statement was I talked about my cultural experience as a, you know, my family immigrated here, and I talked about that aspect, that perspective of being a Canadian citizen and being interested in the procedures and institutions that I talked about earlier. I talked about how I was trained as a classical pianist and singer before. I wanted to study music. Mom also said that was not a good idea. But I mentioned that in my personal statement as, you know, as a musician, this is a unique perspective that I think I have. I talked about my interest in the public service. I talked about my interest in Parliament as well. But how I tied it together was all of these things, I think, are best studied, again, from a perspective that combines two cultural traditions, which at here at McGill we do. In terms of... Oh, another important aspect of your application... sont tes références. Alors, parfois, tu essaies de penser à tes références, like, oh my goodness, who am I going to contact? My best advice would be, trouve des personnes qui te connaissent le mieux. Alors, même si tu connais le premier ministre du Canada, mais il va t'écrire une lettre qui ne parle pas de tes qualités, ne parle pas de, you know, this person is really, really great because they're lots of fun and they're caring and they're compassionate and this is the work they do in their community or this is why they're a great student. It's better to get a professor or two who really know you well and can talk about what qualities in particular you would bring to the faculty and why they support your candidacy. So that's something to keep in mind. So don't stress about finding the most fancy reference. Stress about finding someone who knows you really well. In terms of my student experience, so 1L is, as you saw, there's a lot of mandatory courses that you have to take. It's very manageable, and it's very, no one believes me, it's very fun. Like, no one believes me when I say law school is fun. They look at me, they're like, you're lying, this is not true. I met some of the most interesting people I think I'll ever come across. You know, you meet people from all across the country, you meet people from all across the world, and everyone has a really particular reason why they've chosen to come to McGill. So 1L is really that process of getting to know people who have all these different perspectives, and you're all working really, really hard. So it's a bit of a crazy social experiment of sorts, but it's a good time and you grow a lot as a person. I'm in my second year at the faculty, so I'm starting to take part in some different activities that open up to you as you get into your upper years. So I'm volunteering at the legal clinic. I work as a managing editor on the McGill Journal of Law and Health, and I'm a student ambassador as well. So there's lots of different ways to get involved in the faculty. And think about those when you're doing your application as well. Like, what kind of things do you think you could bring to the faculty outside your studies? Because McGill is a very community-oriented faculty, I found, and you know, it's always fun to have more people who want to work with you on projects outside of contracts and civil property. So what other things can you bring to the faculty that would be interesting to mention in your applications? What else can I mention? Yeah, in 2L, in 1L you'll learn this as well, just in terms of a work-life balance. It's very, like I said, it's very manageable. What's unique about this faculty I found is everyone likes to help each other out. I mean, I've never studied at a different faculty, so I don't know. But what I found is that everyone here, I mean, you need notes, you'll find 10 people who are wanting to give them to you. You need help, you'll find 15 people and professors who are wanting to help. And that kind of mentality is something to keep in mind as well when you're doing your applications, kind of how are you a community-minded person and why do you think you'd fit into that aspect of our faculty? Because I think that that's something that we really pride ourselves on and something to consider for sure. So that's all I have now for my mini presentation, but yeah, thanks.
Hi everyone, my name's Ali. I am in my second year of the Law MBA program here at McGill. So I'm the joint program student that the associate dean was talking about. Am I? Yeah. Perfect. Is that what my voice sounds like? After listening to Janelle's presentation, I really wish I had prepared for this, like, at all. I don't have notes, so the question and answer period will be my strong suit. I come from a kind of unique background into law school. I did a pharmacy degree at the University of Toronto before I got here, with my research being in pharmacoeconomics and pharmacoepidemiology, which is just a fancy way of saying I do statistics about how drugs should be priced and how diseases spread and stuff like that. It's really, really, really boring. It is. I worked in East Africa in my second year of pharmacy school, doing drug pricing and studying antibiotic patterns and other boring stuff. And I only mention this is boring because law school is so much more interesting. I'm not even kidding about this. So I did all this stuff in East Africa. And after I got back to pharmacy school, I kept working with the organization I was working for in East Africa. And I realized that being a clinical pharmacist in a hospital, dealing with doctors, dealing with patients, it just wasn't what I wanted in my life, because I wasn't doing enough to help society and help the world. And that sounds cliche, but it's true. So I took a job with the government for a little while I was in school. And during my fourth year, one of my mentors at the Faculty of Pharmacy told me to apply to law school. Now, it's really difficult to say which schools to apply to because you can't really decide. I mean, you guys, as new applicants, have so many choices in law schools. So the question really for you guys would be, why did I choose McGill? I guess that's what you're dying to know. And to be honest, after being at U of T for such a long time, it was really, really nice to be in a different environment. If you go to the U of T campus, if you go to this campus, they're both totally different environments. But that wasn't the major reason. Regardless of the fact that McGill felt much more comfortable to me, it was largely due to the fact that McGill is different than most other law schools. It's different in the sense that here you view law not as a career, but rather as a window. And that sounds metaphorical and syllogistic, but you view it's a window in the sense that the common law and civil law degree opens up so many different opportunities for you. Rather than practicing simply as a lawyer, the civil law degree allows me to use my knowledge in multiple parts of the world. The majority of the world actually operates under a civil law system, with a few exceptions, including Canada, the United States, and the United Kingdom. Having that kind of knowledge really helps me operate and do work in East Africa, especially with regard to policy. It also gives me more opportunities to work in countries like, after doing my MBA right now, I'm doing a project in Dubai. It's really interesting to have those kinds of opportunities and to view law like this sort of, to view McGill law and the bilingual transsystemic ideology as a kind of way to see different elements of the law that you probably wouldn't see at a different faculty. So my personal statement, I guess that would be the next part, right? Okay. My personal statement was interesting. I had fun writing the thing. The first draft was interesting because I actually specifically remember, I started it by saying, and I quote, I find myself on a precipice in life, full stop, end quote. And I specifically wrote that because the Batman movie was coming out the week after, and I'm actually serious. And there was a picture in the promo material with Batman standing on a building on a precipice. So the point of that is to tell you all that get your personal statement reviewed by someone that you trust and someone that will actually look at it. Because at that point, I had a lot of professors at the Faculty of Pharmacy at U of T that were just like, oh my God, everything you do is amazing. You can't do any wrong. And I gave it to one professor that I really, really, really trusted, and he told me that it was garbage. So I rewrote it. And that's probably why I got in. As for what I got involved in here, there's actually a lot of opportunities here. Compared to other colleagues that I speak to at other law schools, there's a lot more you can do at McGill, especially in your first year. In my first year, I was a junior editor on the Journal of Dispute Resolution, which looks at international arbitration and negotiation. And in my past summer, I was an editing lead with the Private Law and Justice Research Board, research team. So the opportunities, like these kinds of opportunities don't exist at other schools just because of the trans-systemic nature of McGill. And since we operate in different countries, and the civil law allows you to get that global perspective, and also because of the focus on human rights. So I feel that if I were to get you guys to leave with one thing from this presentation that I didn't prepare for, aside from the Batman thing, it would probably be the fact that McGill offers you a lot more opportunities, and you should take advantage of those should you come to this school.
Wow. Thank you both very much for that heartwarming testimonial. I see a little bit of the U of T side, the competitive kind of comparative type. That's great. It's all fair game. I didn't prompt them to say anything about the program specifically. Alors, si, est-ce qu'il y a des questions plus pour la perspective étudiante que vous voudriez poser? There's one, two. Sorry, maybe I'll, in this area, no. Thank you. Okay. Well, we'll start with these ones. Okay, I have to just sort through to make sure they're not actually admissions questions. Sometimes that happens. Okay, so that's an admissions one. Yeah, that's also a I know. That's we'll get to the thick of that. Well. Yeah, that's also an admissions one. Okay, this one too. So we will get to them, but they are, you know, about GPA calculations and definitions of the categories and personal statement guidelines more than substance. Off the cuff, anyone for a student perspective question? They were must have been so thorough and convincing. You don't have any questions, so you're free to go if you want. Oh, did I? Sure, it's not an admissions question, but it is pertaining to the first part of the presentation. So the question was about. Clerkships and how they're attributed. So there are two types of clerkships, as we explained, the one that you do in course and then the ones that you do after graduation. So there are different processes. After graduation, you're more kind of applying on your own, I guess. But so for the in course, there is an internal application with all of these tribunals that you would fill out at a certain point in the year. You know, when you submit your credentials, and there's an internal selection committee at the faculty that would communicate their recommendations to the different tribunals we have partnerships with, and then along with the documents, and they decide to agree with us or not on who to take on. And before all of that, each year they would tell us how many spots they have. And I know the things, you know, it's not... For these non-course activities, the GPA in law is not a big factor in those types of applications. The same if you're going on exchange, for example. I mean, we have to make sure there's a certain minimum, but it looks at different aspects, a lot at motivation, and obviously we want to spread as many students as we can to, you know, we want to make sure we fill all of our spots, so we... do it that way. There are some courts, for example, the Quebec Court of Appeal, which is the higher ranked court, might be, you know, more, you know, looking a little bit more at the academic strength for that one. But so there's an internal process and then kind of a external process for those. For the post-graduation ones, we would give you the information about
the, you know, the application process and the deadlines, you would apply on your own, and then there would be an interview process, etc. In that case, they might ask you for transcripts and things like that. There are a few exceptions where, well, I know for the Supreme Court clerkship ones, it is you need to be endorsed by your faculty to present your candidacy. So that, and that has a completely unique process, and we have plenty of information sessions. You know, 2 years before you actually apply, you can come and kind of gather information. So for that, you would put your application together, kind of convince the faculty that you would be a good representative, well, a good candidate, and then the faculty writes a reference letter, which is really an endorsement. So it's a two-step process. And then at the other end, and I'm not the expert on the Supreme Court clerkship, but obviously you send into the court, they choose who they want to interview out of the so many that McGill recommended, and then you would go through that selection process on the other end. And with clerkships, it's the judge that decides who they want to work with. And so you know from the outset, it's not the I mean, the court hires you, but it's to work with a particular judge. Non-admissions questions? You have a lot. Now I'm straying away from the ones who, they're non-admissions. They're program questions. Oh, okay. So that has priority. I'll just repeat the question. It's about your typical day and week as a student, and if you want to come and answer, or either of you.
Okay, so a typical day in 1L, we had a lot of early morning classes last year, I feel like, so but 9 a.m. is not so bad. And those are, you can choose either French or English, but depending on that, that's mainly the only selection you really get for first year. So yeah, you're in class for, I would say, a lot of the time, much of the day, up until about, 3:30 or 4. You have like hour-long breaks in between, usually, or a couple of hours, and at the beginning of the year, you use that to socialize and make new friends and go to like all the fairs that they have, telling you about all their cool clubs. And then around mid-October, you go to the library and you, start getting some studying in. But throughout, like I said, it's very manageable. So you're in school for the day, like a regular work day, really. And if you get a lot of your studying done during the day, I mean, I didn't find, outside of crunch time, like midterms and exams, I didn't find that I was, you know, burning the midnight oil. I found like if I worked consistently throughout the week and throughout the day, it was pretty manageable. And then a big part of your life is Thursday Night Coffee House, which is like an institution here. You go and all your faculty goes, and sometimes professors go, and you hang out and chat. So it's very much like high school, as we said before. You're in school throughout the day, and then extracurriculars after. I don't know.
I don't know. I would say I spent like every day from like 9 to like 10 here, 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. But then I lived in the library. Nice. I took it overboard in first year. You definitely don't have to do that. I would say like the normal time to stay here is until like 5 o'clock, and then people leave. It's by no means like extremely taxing until you like get to midterms and finals and whatnot, right? Yeah. We have another question. Oh, okay. Sure. So the question was about how we get to pick courses in English or French. I didn't pick any French courses, actually, because I came from Toronto, and I didn't speak French very well. I actually got interviewed before I got in about how well I could speak French. But, yeah, you can choose however many courses you want in French or English. The one thing I would probably tell you is that legal methodology is bilingual. Civil law property, the first year property course, is all, every reading is in French, so if you're not proficient in comprehending French, it will be extremely difficult. And students frequently ask questions in both English and French, so you might get lost halfway along a class if you don't speak really good French.
As a native from Ottawa and embracing bilingualism, though, it's very manageable. And like, you do choose your French or English courses, but I think if like you have to expect that you might be in a French course if an English section is full. If that's the way I understand it. Like, there's just be prepared to study in both languages. And as Ali mentioned, civil property, most of the cases are in French. So be prepared for that aspect of it as well. But also don't be afraid. We were just talking about this before. Like, I found that even though I speak mainly English, like, it's usually just like a fear thing. Once you like take the first bite and just dive in and you're like, I'm going to ask a question in French today. Everyone's really supportive of people speaking in both languages. People switch mid-sentence, people switch mid-word. Like, it's very much a bilingual faculty, and it's very accepted and it's very encouraged. So don't let the language thing be a barrier. But we're going to take one more question.
You can pick one. So the question is about other parts of law that we kind of are exposed to throughout the curriculum. It's actually interesting. There's a lot. In the first year, you have a course called Foundations, which goes through a lot of different legal systems in the history of the common and civil law and how they kind of branch off. There's also courses, I think there's a course in Talmudic law, and a friend of mine is just researching Sharia law on his own. So there's a lot of opportunities to look at different kinds of law. Did you want to?
That pretty much covers it. As Ali said, you take foundations, and also there's some really great Aboriginal law courses that Professor Anker teaches, I believe. So, lots of opportunities to study different legal traditions, and often in your classes as well, like a professor will start talking about a different tradition because that's what we do at McGill. So, yeah.
Sorry to cut the questions short. Maybe what we can do, if you do have a student perspective, maybe on your way out, or you can stay around and answer if you want to go and spend a few minutes asking them the questions, we can do it that way. But being mindful of the time and how there are admissions topics to cover, I want to make sure we keep enough time to do so. So about the I'll speak more about the bilingualism. Now we're going to jump into the French part of it, so you'll see how it's lived. Alors, donc là, on va aborder la partie vraiment sur, vous avez décidé que vous voulez aller en droit, puis vous êtes prêt à vous lancer dans la demande d'admission. Il y a quelques informations générales, des choses à garder en tête quand vous pensez à faire une demande. Attends, je vais ressortir une note. Et puis, vous devez faire une certaine réflexion qui va vous avantager le moment venu d'écrire votre essai personnel. Posez-vous vraiment la question, quelles sont vos motivations pour vouloir étudier le droit? Parce que des fois, ça va vous aider à être plus convaincant et plus convaincu de pourquoi vous voulez le faire. Il y a toutes sortes de raisons. Hein. Le droit, c'est comme, ça paraît bien, d'habitude, ça rend les parents heureux, c'est comme une bonne formation général, qui peut ouvrir plein de portes. Puis ça peut être très convaincant, mais ça peut être aussi un peu par défaut, des fois, de vouloir aller en droit. Donc, posez-vous la question, et ça va vous aider par la suite. Parallèle à ça, puis on en a parlé un petit peu, il y a plusieurs facultés de droit au Canada, il y en a plusieurs au Québec, il y en a plusieurs au Canada, il y en a à l'étranger. Chaque faculté de droit au Canada, il n'y a pas vraiment le standard est quand même assez élevé partout au Canada. Il n'y a pas de mauvaise faculté de droit. Chacune a sa force. Je pense que vous comprenez la force de McGill, c'est vraiment la vision qu'elle se fait du droit et la façon dont c'est enseigné et les opportunités que ça peut ouvrir. Donc ça, c'est notre niche avec le caractère bilingue. Certains domaines de spécialisation aussi qui sont nos forces. Mais si vous êtes intéressé, dans une autre sorte de droit qui est plus fort à l'Université de Victoria ou à l'Université de Montréal, ça peut être un très bon environnement pour vous également. Donc, faites vos recherches, pensez à ce qui vous intéresse et puis le genre d'environnement dans lequel vous voulez aller. Puis, vous allez sûrement être le plus convaincant comme candidat si vous choisissez bien les facultés de droit où vous faites vos demandes. Puis, il n'y a rien de préjudiciable à faire plusieurs demandes à plusieurs facultés de droit. On s'attend évidemment, si vous êtes intéressé par le droit, à ce que vous ne mettez pas nécessairement tous vos œufs dans le même panier. Quoiqu'il y a un bon nombre de demandes qui viennent, c'est des gens vraiment qui ont décidé qu'ils voulaient venir à McGill puis qu'ils ne font pas de demandes ailleurs. Donc, dans un sens ou dans l'autre, ça peut être très convaincant. Bon, de manière générale, plus là, on tombe dans la logistique, on vous encourage à faire vos recherches vous-même sur le processus d'admission avant de nous téléphoner ou de nous écrire, parce qu'il y a comme une question de volume. Là, à un moment donné, on met le plus d'informations possible sur notre site Internet pour justement vous permettre d'être autosuffisant dans la mesure du possible. En tout cas, tout ça, c'est sur notre site Web. Et puis, on est là. Si vous avez vraiment une question, vous n'êtes pas sûr dans quelle catégorie de candidat vous vous trouvez ou quelque chose de vraiment spécifique, évidemment, ça va nous faire plaisir de vous aider. Alors, la politique d'admission de la faculté, que vous pouvez voir là, elle est vraiment résumée de façon très courte. Vous aurez compris, nous, on est très conscients de la nature de notre programme, puis on cherche des étudiants qui vont être les plus aptes à réussir dans notre programme et puis à contribuer, qu'il y a vraiment un apprentissage mutuel avec nos étudiants. Donc, on cherche des gens qui seraient à l'aise dans un environnement unique comme le nôtre, de nature comparative, transsystémique et bilingue. Également, bon, essayer de trouver ces candidats-là, il faut qu'on s'en remette à plus que leurs notes. Donc, on fait une évaluation globale de chaque dossier. L'évaluation globale ou holistique, c'est quelque chose qui est très... dont on est très fier. Ça prend beaucoup de ressources de la part de notre faculté, mais on investit ces ressources-là parce qu'on veut vraiment trouver des gens qui, oui, d'une part, nous convainquent que comme étudiants, ils vont être bons, puis ils vont être capables de suivre les cours, de bien réussir, mais qui aussi vont apporter quelque chose à notre dialogue collectif sur le droit. Donc, vous comprenez, nous, on est intéressés à pouvoir étudier le droit, comprendre comment l'autre fait quelque chose. C'est dans la nature même de notre programme. Donc, on ne peut pas faire ça s'il n'y a pas plusieurs perspectives dans la classe. Donc, au-delà des notes, bon, on va regarder les autres éléments du dossier. Les CV, l'essai personnel, les lettres de référence étant les outils qu'on a pour le faire. Puis, on va rechercher une classe qui est aussi diverse que possible. Puis c'est plus détaillé. Tous ces critères-là sont plus détaillés sur le site Web. Donc, je vous invite à aller voir. Ça, la question du bilinguisme, elle est réelle et je sais qu'elle occupe les pensées de beaucoup de candidats. Nous, ce qu'on recherche, et c'est un critère d'admission, c'est vraiment quelqu'un qui comprend très bien les deux langues officielles, du français et l'anglais. Donc, c'est passif dans le sens qu'on vous n'allez jamais être obligé de parler, d'écrire vos examens, d'écrire vos travaux dans votre autre langue, mais on va vous bombarder avec de l'information orale et écrite dans les deux langues, puis il faut être capable de suivre le rythme. Donc, c'est comme un niveau au moins intermédiaire haut. Comme niveau très souvent avancé. Puis des fois, ce sont les étudiants ambassadeurs qui font passer ce message-là mieux que moi je peux le faire. C'est sûr que moi, c'est la version officielle que je vous donne, mais il y en a qui disent aux candidats, dans la réalité, moi, je suis, moi, l'étudiant, je suis pas mal parfaitement bilingue. J'ai fait, disons, toutes mes études secondaires en français. Et ça me prend quand même plus de temps à faire mes lectures en français qu'en anglais. Puis, comme il y a un effort additionnel requis pour quelqu'un qui est même au niveau avancé. Donc, c'est pour ça que d'emblée, on veut qu'il y ait un certain niveau à l'admission pour pouvoir que ces personnes, que tous nos étudiants soient
assez à l'aise pour ne pas avoir une crise existentielle quand ils arrivent.
There's a real wake-up call. I think sometimes, and you know, you look on forums and you get different points of view. Oh, there are always English summaries for every class. Don't worry, you can kind of work your way through the program and kind of avoid the French altogether. You may not be able to take all of your classes in English. If it's full, we will put you in the French section. And we don't want you to complain about it afterwards. Okay, because you've been admitted on the premise that you have the ability to understand. And there might not be a summary of the course in English, but the method of teaching that course might have changed, where you would be put on it's a lot more active pedagogy than just going to class passively listening, then reading your secret summaries on the side. So you might be put on the spot a lot more with a lot more, French and English coming your way, and so you don't want to be, really stressed out and thinking it's going to ruin your law school career because you're not as fast as others. So that's my spiel about the bilingualism part. Là, on va regarder juste un peu vous donner un ordre d'idée. Puis ce sont les statistiques de l'année d'avant. Les statistiques de l'année qui vient de se terminer ne sont pas encore officielles, mais les chiffres ne changent pas tellement. Donc, juste pour vous donner un ordre d'idée, on reçoit en moyenne 1300 demandes. On fait un certain nombre d'offres qui tournent autour de 250-260. Le nombre de places est là. Et la moyenne entrante pour les universitaires est autour de 84. Cette année, c'était 85%. Pour ceux qui ont fait des études universitaires. Puis pour ceux qui ont fait le LSAT, la moyenne était de 163. Il y a plus, puis ça, on l'a dans notre dépliant, si ça vous intéresse, vous pourrez toujours venir à la faculté en chercher. Puis ça va être, c'est sur notre site également, où ça va l'être prochainement. Il y a toute une fourchette de notes qui sont admises. Là. C'est sûr que 84, c'est excellent, mais je sais qu'on est allé jusqu'à 75, jusqu'à, 94, quelque chose comme ça. Puis, pour le LSAT, on est descendu dans les dernières années jusqu'à, 150, jusqu'à 178, ou en tout cas le maximum qu'on peut avoir. Je sais que c'est 180, puis il y a des années où on en a, des gens qui ont 180, d'autres années non. Alors, je pense que c'est ça qui fait la démonstration du caractère holistique de notre processus d'admission, c'est qu'on est prêt à prendre un certain nombre de risques académiques au nom de ce que la personne peut apporter de plus. Ça ne veut pas dire qu'on favorise les dossiers académiquement faibles aux dossiers forts. Ça, il y a une petite nuance à faire. En termes de la composition de la classe, autour de 18% viennent directement du cégep. Puis, ça dépend des années. Des fois, il y en a plus qui ont des maîtrises et des doctorats que ceux qui viennent du cégep, mais ça s'équivaut à peu près. Et c'est pas tout le monde qui écrit le LSAT. Ça reflète la nature de notre bassin d'admission. Environ 35-40% de la classe aura écrit le LSAT avant d'être admis. Puis c'est très rare que les Cégepiens le fassent. L'âge moyen est de 24 ans. Donc, quand vous pensez 24 ans, 18% de Cégepiens qui arrivent à 19-20 ans, il y a beaucoup de gens qui ont fait autre chose que juste leur bac universitaire pour arriver à une moyenne de 24 ans. Pour le bassin de Cégepiens, c'est un peu plus compétitif quand on regarde les chiffres. Là, par rapport au nombre de demandes et le nombre d'offres qui ont été faites, c'est plus comme un sur 10, plus ou moins. Là encore, on donne un éventail qui vont, disons, d'une cotère de autour de 30, un peu plus que 30, jusqu'à, ça dépend des années, mais une cotère que j'aurais jamais eue. L'information, ici on vous donne les Cégepiens, eux seront vus en entrevue avant qu'une offre leur soit faite. Donc, il y a comme une étape supplémentaire pour les Cégepiens. Là, je vous donne quelques autres petites statistiques. OK. Là, on tombe dans le les exigences d'admission. Donc, du point de vue de l'éligibilité, vous devez avoir, par le temps que vous allez commencer vos études de droit, vous devez avoir terminé votre DEC si vous êtes au cégep ou votre bac français fait au Québec. Vous pouvez être encore considéré comme un candidat cégepien si vous avez fait jusqu'à un an d'études universitaires. Donc, faire votre demande là, dans le semestre d'hiver de votre première année, vous seriez encore éligible comme cégepien. Ensuite, vous tombez dans la catégorie des universitaires et là, il faut avoir au moins 60 crédits universitaires au moment où vous commenceriez le droit. Ça, c'est une règle là, qui existe. Je ne sais pas si un jour on ne va jamais la changer, mais dans les faits, c'est tellement compétitif que quelqu'un qui a 60 crédits puis qui n'aura pas un bac complété sera éligible, mais ne sera pas nécessairement ou très rarement admissible. Parce que comparé à d'autres, nous, on préfère avoir des gens qui détiennent un diplôme universitaire dans cette catégorie-là. Donc, la plupart des gens postulent dans leur dernière année pour avoir complété leur programme. Ça, c'est les grandes catégories. Il y a les candidats adultes. On s'attend au même genre de pedigree académique. Mais la définition d'un candidat mature, c'est quelqu'un qui a interrompu ses études depuis plus que 5 ans ou pendant plus que 5 ans. Ça change. On a différentes catégories à part les cégepiens où il y a une entrevue. Ça ne change pas vraiment grand-chose à la façon dont les dossiers sont analysés. Alors ça, ce sont les exigences académiques d'éligibilité. Ensuite, il y a l'exigence du bilinguisme. Et dans les faits, on va regarder, on ne demande pas de test standardisé ou quoi que ce soit. Il y a de l'information sur notre site web quant au niveau, puis il y a comme un test que vous pouvez faire vous-même qui explique, c'est pour vous situer à peu près. Mais on va regarder dans votre demande ce que vous avez indiqué comme votre niveau de compréhension des deux langues, comment vous l'avez appris. On va regarder dans vos relevés de notes si vous avez pris des cours dans les deux langues ou des cours de langue ou en échange dans une université qui enseigne dans l'autre langue. On va chercher des preuves dans votre dossier tel qu'il est pour se rassurer que vous avez le niveau nécessaire. Si un dossier qui semble avoir aucun anglais ou français, mais dans les faits, c'est plus le français qui nous préoccupe, le dossier va être refusé. C'est comme un premier tri. Alors, on peut perdre quelqu'un qui a une merveilleuse cotère. Quoique les cégepiens, c'est quand même plus rare là, qu'il n'y ait pas un petit peu de français quand même, là, mais disons un très bon dossier de Colombie-Britannique avec un LSAT extraordinaire, ça va être un refus direct s'il n'y a pas les exigences. In terms of the... So then we get more into the different documents you have to provide. In terms of the academic record, so you have to provide to us all of your academic history, certainly everything from university on. If you're applying from outside Quebec and you didn't go to CEGEP, we will not want to get anything from high school or anything like that. But anything you've done in university, you know, first degree, second degree, exchange program, summer program, and everything you need to submit transcripts for. At the stage of applying, it can be unofficial transcripts that you would upload, like your student copy, for example, or a scanned transcript if you have one. So if you have gone to CEGEP, you need to provide your permanent code, and we will go and get your transcripts, CEGEP transcript directly. Also, there are ways within the Quebec system to get transcripts as well, like between Quebec universities. So that's explained in more detail on our website. In terms of substance, the committee will look for... So there is a GPA calculation, and there was a question about that. I think I'll answer it now because it's a typical question. So what we do first, there is someone who has a computer program with all of the scales, with all of the universities, You know, some are on 10 out of, you know, on 10, some are on 4.0, some are on 4.3. So that computer program rescales everything back to a 4.3 GPA. And so that calculation is done. Every year of your undergrad will go into that calculation, whether you changed the program, failed a term. So we're very thorough in that sense. Not all law schools do it that way. Some choose to look only at the best 2 years. Some look at the last 3 years. We look at all the years, and all the years go into that calculation. So there's that exercise of determining your GPA for a university candidate. For a CJEP candidate, it's done for us. And then there is, so that's one thing, because we need to have a number for each file, because we run statistics on these things. And then the real substantive analysis will be done by the committee members who read your file. And they will go through your transcript line by line and look at the type of course, well, the program you were in, the courses you took. Is there a nice progression from, you know, lower levels to higher levels? Is there consistency? What were the class averages in those courses? Is it a program that was particularly rigorous? Or was it, you know, a lot of electives? Or are you taking 100-level courses in your last year? These are all things that the committee will be looking at. So we're looking for consistency is very important. Obviously, performance is also important. Improvement is obviously better than getting worse. And then the range of the coursework might be noted as well. Although doing an honors program where you do a lot more of your concentration courses can be very compelling as well, but it might be interesting to see that you branch off and take a few other, not the BERD courses, but a few other courses outside of your discipline that might be interesting as well to the committee. There is no preferred pre-law program. Sometimes we get that question. No. It would go against everything we believe in, so we admit, yes, we do admit people from arts and political science and philosophy and history, but we do admit people from pharmacy and music and engineering, and we think those are really important to have in the class. So if you're in CJEP and let's say you apply and you don't get admitted to law and you're looking to go into an undergrad program, really do what you want because you'll perform best, and then you'll have done something you like for 3 or 4 years, and it's it can all be compelling to us. Okay, the LSAT, why write it? Well, if you're applying outside of Quebec, you have, within North America, you have no choice, you will be writing it. So that can be a very good reason why you're writing it. You might write it within the Quebec context nonetheless, if you choose to do so. If you think your academic performance is out of range with what has been admitted, or, you know, out of range with the bulk of the admissions, which is between, let's say, 82 and 86 or 7%, you might consider writing it, because it will give another academic performance element to your file that might bring it up. If you do write it, or if you plan on writing it, even though it's not a requirement for eligibility at McGill, you will need to disclose that you have done it, because the committee will want to see it. So there is a bit of a gamble there. But and about, as I said, 35 to 40% of the class will end up having done the LSAT. When to write it? No later than December is our recommendation. The LSAT is written, I think, in June, September, October, December, and February. So we recommend you write no later than December, because your file will be, it's not that it won't be canceled because incomplete, but it will be pending until we get your score. So if you do it in October, you're fine. If you do it in December, you're just stalling your file for a month or so, or, you know, a month and a half, but you're still in the bulk of everything. But if you choose to write it in February, then
you're stalling your file for like more than half of the cycle. So the class will be probably half full by the time you're ready to be reviewed, and then you're competing for half the spots. So some people still choose to take that risk because they think they will do so much better in February than their file if they submitted it right now. So these are all things to think about. You also have to provide two reference letters, no more than two. If you provide a third one, it will not be read. We recommend academic letters. Sometimes for mature candidates who have been out of school for a long time, it's really kind of impractical to be able to get those academic letters, so a professional letter might make a lot of sense. At the end of the day, every candidate is free to submit a letter from whomever, the Prime Minister, or we recommend academic because it's what speaks to the committee the most, and they, this being an academic program, we're not hiring you for a job. We're hiring, well, we're admitting you for an academic program. That's what speaks the most to the committee. But if you choose, you can provide a professional one and an academic one if you choose to do so. The academic one better be quite strong if you take that, make that decision. Personal letters of reference, we don't see that many of those anymore, but it used to happen. You know, my uncle, the judge, will write me a letter, and I'm sure that's, you know, we'll name drop, and everything will, you know, it'll have more weight because it's from someone within that community. It might have the opposite effect on the committee. It might have a chilling effect on the committee, actually, to see a letter that's kind of irrelevant in content. So, FYI, just don't bother. Like, really, it's more work to find someone who was in a teaching or a supervisory role. You know, it exposes you more, obviously, you know, to real critical, a real critical analysis of who you are, but that's where the crux of the matter is. That's what we want to know. Complacent type letters are just not helpful. It happens less and less. I think it's like a mindset that, you know, is phasing out. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention, I went to a recruitment event in Toronto and I met with all of my counterparts at non-Quebec law schools. And instructions on these types of things really vary from school to school. Like at Queen's, they were explaining how it really is better to have an academic and a professional letter because it kind of shows the well-roundedness. And so, you know, there are these little differences. When you look into law schools, just be mindful of these things because it's not a cookie cutter. Not all law schools approach things the same way. So just bear that in mind. Okay. Alors, le CV. Le CV, bon, il doit tenir sur deux pages. Ça, c'est une politique qui a été adoptée par le comité d'admission il y a 2 ans. Il faut qu'il tienne sur 2 pages. Et si vous soumettez un CV plus long, le comité s'est entendu, ils ne vont pas lire les autres pages. Donc, il y a peut-être l'information qui sera perdue si vous soumettez un CV trop long. Il faut que le CV soit adapté à notre demande. Donc, pas que c'est absolument fatal, mais de voir un dossier qui n'a pas été, un CV qui n'a pas été mis à jour où on dit ah, je cherche une place dans votre entreprise pour avoir un environnement de travail dynamique, ça montre juste un petit peu de sloppiness, là. Alors, juste pensez à ça. C'est sûr que comme il y a un volet académique, tout ce qui est distinction académique et tout ça, vous devriez le mentionner, mais tout ce que vous pensez, tout ce que vous voulez représenter de vous-même, vous pouvez le mettre. Il faut utiliser votre jugement. C'est d'avoir été, je sais pas, dans votre club d'échecs au début du secondaire. Vous pouvez décider si oui ou non c'est ça que vous voulez représenter de votre personne à ce stade-ci. Alors, donc, les activités, le travail, Si vous avez travaillé, mettez le nombre d'heures, si c'est pendant les études, parce que ça, ça fait partie de l'évaluation globale du dossier. On peut voir, ah, cette personne-là, disons, prenait 4 cours au lieu de 5 à l'université, mais on voit qu'elle travaillait 25 heures, 30 heures par semaine. Ça peut nous aider à mettre les pièces du casse-tête ensemble. Tout ce que vous avez fait à l'extérieur, que vous voudriez, dont vous voudriez saisir le comité, n'hésitez pas. Donc, c'est un volet vraiment important, le CV dans notre contexte. Ensuite, l'essai personnel. Bon, alors, et vous, sur le site, vous pouvez aller voir, il y a une section qui explique qu'on vous donne autant de détails qu'on choisit de vous donner sur ce qu'on veut dans l'essai personnel. Les grandes lignes, c'est, les grandes questions, c'est, bon, pourquoi que vous, auxquelles vous devez répondre, c'est pourquoi le droit, pourquoi McGill, puis ce que vous penseriez contribuer, un peu ce volet de communauté-là. Puis le comité choisit de ne pas vraiment vous en dire beaucoup plus, parce que c'est ça qu'on veut voir. Si on vous disait, si on vous en disait plus, ça serait moins personnel, ils commenceraient à tous se ressembler, puis là, ça serait un exercice un peu vain. Donc, le meilleur conseil, c'est vraiment d'avoir fait la réflexion vous-même, puis d'être honnête avec vous-même et avec nous dans votre essai personnel. C'est pas un résumé du CV, c'est pas un résumé de notre programme remanché. Les bons essais personnels ne sont pas ces choses-là. Écrivez dans la langue dans laquelle vous êtes le plus confortable. Vous n'avez pas besoin de faire preuve de votre bilinguisme dans votre essai personnel, à moins d'être vraiment à l'aise dans les deux langues, mais c'est vraiment plus important d'être convaincant. Ensuite, c'est vrai que c'est important de donner le temps d'y retravailler. Il y a comme une réflexion qui avance là, au fur et à mesure qu'on le fait. C'est une bonne idée de le montrer à quelqu'un qui vous connaît bien, parce qu'il va pouvoir voir si l'essai personnel vous ressemble. Et des fois, je sais qu'il y a toute une industrie là, autour de l'essai personnel, de gens qui peuvent les revoir pour vous. Il y en a sur Internet. Il y a des fois des gens qui se font payer pour revoir les essais personnels. Alors, en tout cas, moi, je serais très sceptique, parce qu'à la base, ça le dit, là, c'est personnel. Et on espère que c'est une démarche authentique de la part de la personne. En bout de ligne, c'est sûr qu'on ne sait pas ce qu'on ne sait pas, dans le sens que un essai personnel qui est truffé d'erreurs, en quelque part, montre peut-être plus d'authenticité qu'un essai qui est parfaitement écrit, parce qu'on peut se douter que celui qui a des erreurs est authentique à la personne qui l'a écrit et qui n'a pas été revu. Mais en tout cas, je sais qu'on dit de le montrer à beaucoup de gens, mais il faut que ça soit vraiment une démarche personnelle à la base. Mais c'est vrai que c'est important de revoir votre grammaire puis votre orthographe, ça c'est sûr. Bon, il y a des conditions là, en termes de longueur. Je pense qu'il y avait une question à ce sujet-là. Minimum ou maximum de pages pour l'essai personnel, maximum de 2. Minimum, il n'y en a pas vraiment qui est dit, mais il y a normalement beaucoup de matière à réflexion et à écrire dans l'essai personnel. Donc, si c'est disons, 3/4 de page, peut-être qu'il vous manque quelque chose dans votre essai personnel. Donc, celle-là est faite. OK, là, je voulais juste faire une question du GPA. Je pense qu'on a répondu. OK. The interview process, just a bit of information. If you get to that point, it's largely for CJEP candidates, although it is at the discretion of the committee to ask anyone for an interview, so it could happen. It's not at your discretion to ask for an interview if you think it would give you another chance to convince us that you're strong. But so if you are called for an interview, it would be for about 22, 25 minutes with two faculty professors. It will be bilingual. Again, what we test is the passive bilingualism, but obviously active bilingualism is great. It will be at the faculty, or sometimes we can accommodate video conference if need be. And this
That's an interesting thing. Sometimes when you read a law, English version and French version, they don't say the same thing, and then you wonder what the law is. So here you can see I said the interviews for CJEP are in February, April, and May, and then I just say interviews are in February. Les entrevues ont lieu en février, avril et mai. De toute évidence, il y a une des deux versions qui est inexacte. Les entrevues de CJEP vont seulement avoir lieu après la date limite en mars. Donc, si jamais on rencontre des candidats non cégepiens, ça se peut que ça ait lieu en février, mais sinon, ça va être plus tard dans fin de l'hiver et au printemps. Check for the time. Okay, we need to zip along. Okay, so the web application is available now. As of September, the season for the university applicants and metro applicants is September 1st to November 1st. So it's available now. The supporting documents can all be unofficial at this point in the process. I think that's made everyone's lives a lot easier. You can upload almost everything on Minerva yourself, except for reference letters that obviously need to come to us in a confidential way from your referees, and that can be done by paper or by email. There are, please make sure your transcript is legible when you upload it. Sometimes, you know, I think it's the Ottawa transcripts are landscape, and then sometimes people scan in a portrait format, and by the time you open it, it's really too small. So try to, because otherwise, we'll need to get in touch with you, and your file will be, you know, it'll make the completion of your file be delayed. Make sure you put a valid email address in the context of your application. Everything will be, everything including the final decision. Ellie, you didn't tell your story about the final decision. So you will get the decision by email as well. So make sure you check. I mean, there is a way to look, obviously, on Minerva to see what your status is, but if we need to get in touch with you because there's a problem with something, it would be by email. It is your responsibility to make sure your file is complete on time, and that includes getting your reference letters in on time and being on top of your referees, even though, you know, sometimes professors have a different sense of deadlines than you might, but it is your responsibility to do so. So if, you know, you have to plan a backup if you see that it's dragging up. Thank you. Okay, so because we do a lot of things internally to the faculty, we are actually a model of expediency in terms of getting your files uploaded and ready to go. But when it is around the deadline, it might take up to 48 hours for us to process what we've gotten from you so that it is reflected on Minerva so you see that we got it. So if it's around the deadline, you know, give us a little bit of time to make sure that everything is uploaded. That leads to the paradox that obviously at the deadline you're stressing out that everything has to be in, which is why you should apply earlier if you can to give yourself that time to not be one out of like 400 people freaking out around the deadline, because our response time will be lower, a little longer around the deadline than any other time of the year. So decrease your stress level and start now. You know, apply, submit your application, and have your supporting documents trickle in if you have to, but get the ball rolling. It's better for us. It's better for you. It's not a rolling admissions in the sense that the earlier you apply, the higher your likelihood of being admitted, which is a model used in other jurisdictions sometimes. You know, they have like a, you can always apply later, but then your chances are lower. For us, we have a deadline, and everyone's kind of considered as a group, but logistically, it's just better to start earlier. Just a list of the deadlines here, just for information, the tuition fees. Okay, I'm just going to This is also available on the website if it's helpful to you just when you're kind of wading through the process. Right now, we are in recruitment information session season. We might be coming to your CGEP. We might, we're doing these types of activities. November 1st is the deadline. We give a few more pieces of information, including when we start making offers, you know, when April 1st is the date by which those who received an offer from December, January, February have until that time to accept the offer. So after April 1st, we kind of reassess where the class is at, and then we continue to make offers. But we make offers throughout. We don't have a date where, you know, a third of our offers go out. And so it looks like it's rolling in that sense, but it's just we communicate them as soon as the committee makes these decisions. And then we hope that by May everyone, well, we hope we do, by May everyone has an answer of some sort. So an admit or refuse or being put on the wait list. Okay, we're getting to the Q&A. I have a few here. If you have any others that you can... we're making you work, Kelly. I'm sorry. Well, we're... Okay, so I'm going to get... I just want to make sure there was one here about the GPA. Regardez-vous l'ensemble des notes universitaires ou uniquement les notes du programme complété lors de la demande d'admission? On regarde l'ensemble des notes. Oui, oui, on regarde. Oui, on regarde tout. Oui. If you have already taken courses at McGill that are part of the major or minor, could you use those credit towards a major or minor? I know that anyone who has taken, let's say, a law course as part of a BA program that has like an international law component to it would not be getting any transfer credits from that, unless you're a real transfer applicant, which means you've done a full year of into a law program at a Canadian faculty. You don't get any, or if you have a full law diploma as an advanced standing student, you don't get anything credited from what you've done prior to the program. Is anything different because it's a minor or a major? I'm not positive about that answer. It's quite specific. This is something we could, because it's outside of law, do we, you know, are we super protective of those credits or are we a little bit looser? I would probably presume we're quite protective, but a question like this, we could send to our the student services side that really know the program that could speak to that. But presumably, I would say no. I agree. Okay, so someone here is currently in university as a mature student, needing quite a few credits in order to complete their undergraduate, their Bachelor of Arts. Do I have to complete my degree before applying? What category should I apply under? You don't really have a choice. If we see that you've been out of school for a minimum of 5 years, even if that is not currently, but in the past, you would be a mature candidate. So it doesn't really change anything. That's the category you'll be in because we report on these types of stats. Do you need to complete your degree? If you have 60 university credits, you're eligible to apply. Again, you might not be very strong at it academically if you don't have a completed undergraduate degree. Okay. Yeah. And do you have a paper where you could write your... Kelly, do you have a spare... Okay. Okay, yep. I have post-its too, if that could be useful. Okay, are GPAs weighed by university, like Bishop's Concordia and McGill? We will scale everything back to a standardized scale. So in that sense, it calibrates itself.
I don't know if there was a subtext to that question about, like, is if one university is tougher and has lower grades, is that taken into account? From an institutional knowledge point of view, the committee members will take that into account. But the GPA calculation will just use that calibration that I talked about. So, question we get quite a few times, should I write the LSAT if I am presently a CJEP student? And then there's a subsection on reference letters. Very few CJEP students do write the LSAT. So, and CJEP students kind of compete, that's like one cohort that's not really compared to the university group in terms of LSAT scores and things like that. So it's not... It would be quite rare. I imagine the person would maybe think of writing the LSAT because the performance in CJEP is well below what we have. You can do so, but it's very rare that it would. And the LSAT is not, it's not there for everyone, so it's not an element that will completely save save an otherwise completely uncompetitive file and vice versa. So the added value of the LSAT compared to like term after term of performance in a CJEP or a university. But for a CJEP candidate, more so than a university candidate, I would recommend to think about it twice before doing it. And then the reference letter, what should the reference letter contain? Actually, we have instructions on our website about like a one-page PDF that you would send to your referee that says both content-wise what we're looking for and format/delivery-wise what they need to do. So, elements, obviously an academic letter would speak to the way you've been in that class, if you've been really inquisitive and curious and made really good comments and your essays showed good research and good logical reasoning skills and obviously, that you were pleasant in class. And it can be helpful also by pleasant, i.e. you're not like a problem student. Those are very rare letters. And then sometimes the referee can give information about the relative strength of your performance compared to your peers. So that might be helpful as well. So if I graduate from CJEP in the fall semester and take the winter semester off, am I still eligible to apply? Yes. If you've graduated and taken time off, then yes, you have the requirements to apply. The Human Rights Internship Program, what year can you apply for this? No earlier than the second year. Oh, yes. Well, you would need to have your first year completed because it starts it's largely in the summer, although I think they're almost all in the summer. So you need to have finished your first year. So you might apply at the end of your first year. But okay. Pas beaucoup de questions en français. So if you're applying as a McGill undergrad candidate, do you need to provide a transcript? That's a good point. No, we will get that. We have our ways of getting that. Okay, about references, is there a link sent to referees after you identify them on your application? That's a good question. No, there's no automated us reaching out to the referee at any point. So you have to go to your referee, provide that information on what we're looking for, and have them provide the answer, and then stay on them until you see that your letter has been received and uploaded on. We will put on Minerva that we received that letter. When is the latest you can change your referees? Will they be notified if you drop them? They would not be notified by us if you drop them. You can change your referee
I mean, at any point until the deadline, yes. I don't think you can change. Let's say your file is complete 2 months in and then you want to change your reference slide. I don't think that would no. Once, no, no. But if, like, you have a last second, oh, my gosh, it's not coming in, then, you know, you can do so up until the deadline. Usually the deadline, because we do receive some by mail also, like, we'll wait, like, a couple of working days to see whatever would come in by mail. So there are a few days there for reference letters where we can be, like, work with you a little bit. Okay, as an ethnic minority, should I declare as such in my letter? If you want to, you are encouraged to do so, because it's part of that. It's one of the elements of diversity we're looking for. Explaining, if you can tie it back to your reasons for wanting to study law or your path to law, that might make it even more compelling. If I have an MA as well as a BA, how much are the notes from my MA considered compared to the BA? They will be considered, but given less weight. The one standardized thing we have is the undergrad, and this program is an undergrad program in the sense it's, you know, relatively large enrollment classes where you have to be autonomous and, you know, write your exams, and so the performance in undergrad is what is most probant for the committee. But if you've done an MA in and of itself, it's something additional that is great. And if you've done well, obviously it'll give it a little boost up. How firm of an idea should I have of my area of practice before I apply? You don't need to have that set. You can sketch an interest, but the reality is people do change their minds when, you know, they have reasons for coming, then they discover what it is. It may or may not be what they thought, and then they discover something new. So, I mean, we won't hold you to whatever area you talk about in your personal statement. How much do I need to detail that interest? You're free to choose how much of that you want to, you know, if you want to make your whole personal statement, have that as a theme, and then bring in all of the answers to the different questions around that, you can do so. Hopefully it won't look like narrow-mindedness. That's the flip side of having too specific and too rigid of an interest. Have fun with that. Okay, what are the diploma's equivalencies to work in Europe, for instance, in France, and how, as law is specific to each country? That's a very, very good point. Law is not like studying business, where you can, you know, kind of go somewhere, study business or science, and kind of be that international business practitioner. Law inherently is jurisdictional. If any law program is less so, it is ours. But the diplomas, each country kind of regulates its own legal practice, and, you know, there are a lot of different stakes in that. You graduate with the civil law and the common law degree. So obviously anywhere in Canada, Quebec being the civil law one, common law opening all of the other doors, you can do so. There are some U.S. states where you can practice, well, write the bar directly as a graduating McGill Law student. You can do so. And then the next step is, once you've joined one of our bars, there might be bar-to-bar agreements that allow you to practice elsewhere. So France does have one with a Quebec bar. So it's kind of a case by case. I know Europe is really changing the way it allows mobility within Europe with different bars. So, you know, in a few years, it might be the case that, you know, from Quebec to France to Belgium, that might be also something on the horizon. But that's, at the current state, as far as I know, France is really easy. England is really easy for the solicitor part as well, as long as you have joined a bar here. And then in the U.S., once you have a U.S. bar, you can move to some other U.S. states. So, but that's really regulated state by state. Is it possible to start in the winter term? Not for the full-time program. No. Not for if you want to be in the program that leads you to get the McGill degrees. Okay, how much do the CJEP, does the CJEP transcript count if I have an undergrad from university? A lot less so. It's not a blank slate necessarily, but we will see files that are admitted with, you know, a very good university performance and an R score, an average in CJEP that would never be in the range of admissible straight out of CJEP. So it's quite difficult to be refused out of CJEP, and it's quite possible to be admitted after your first degree. Do you consider change of program when seeing a failed class? I imagine this question is, if you see on the transcript that someone was struggling in one program, chose to switch to another program, how is that assessed? I don't know. Maybe the people are not here yet anymore. Well, everything will go into that analysis, but obviously if you switch to a program and do really well, then we can infer that you're able to do really well in a program that might be just as convincing. But obviously the GPA will be lower. Yeah, that personal statement. Two pages. If you write the LSAT three times, is that bad? Est-ce que c'est mal? Bilingual question. Mal, non. Non, ça peut, c'est relativement commun de voir des gens qui ont écrit l'examen plusieurs fois. Nous, on regarde tous les scores, puis on fait également une moyenne de tous ces scores-là, ce qui est différent de d'autres facultés de droit qui vont prendre qui vont seulement considérer le score le plus élevé. Donc, ça dépend du score, en quelque part. C'est sûr, quand on a un super bon score dès le début, on s'arrête là. Mais si on voit, si c'est pas trop mal à la base puis qu'il y a une belle amélioration, c'est sûr que c'est mieux que s'il y avait juste le premier. Mais le fait d'écrire plusieurs fois, c'est pas ça en tant que tel qui est négatif, qui est préjudiciable. Question about the permanent code. Is it identical for CJEP and university? The permanent code looks different from a student number, if that's what you're wondering. But if you're applying to McGill in arts and law, it would be the same permanent code you're providing on both applications. How do you acquire a McGill ID? As an applicant, you will get an ID number that will follow you forever. I still have as an employee of McGill, I still have my ID number from when I applied a few years ago. So I don't want to think of how many now, but and the card itself is something you would get only like around the time of registration into the program, obviously. So Minerva, is that the online application? Yes, it's the McGill-wide portal that houses all of the information for students from applying. And then as a student, that's where you would go to sign up for your classes and things like that. And then as a graduate, that's where you would go to order a transcript and things like that. So, yes, it's the McGill-wide, which is different for law. You apply through the McGill portal. If you're applying to law schools in Ontario, then they have their own Ontario-wide portal. So we're not part of that. None of the non-Ontario schools are. So you have to make multiple applications. I forgot to talk about extenuating circumstances. How does a student disclose reasons for deferring graduation for exceptional circumstances given the brevity of the personal statement and CV? There is on the application, one of the fields is, do you have extenuating circumstances, yes or no? You would, if you choose to, you would choose yes, and that would allow you to upload a separate document from your CV and your personal statement where you can touch on that issue there and keep your personal statement and CV for talking about other topics. A candidate could choose to work their path. I mean, this is quite specific, deferring graduation for, you know, it might be medical reasons. This is typically something that would be an extenuating circumstance, separate letter. Sometimes you might, if there are several things like barriers to access to higher education, things like that, that can be sometimes better worked into your motivation for studying law and kind of create a whole, painting that picture about yourself. But it's kind of left to you to decide where you want to put it, but the more circumscribed it is, the more it should be in the separate document. So there is a vehicle for doing that. What kinds of internships are available in the field of refugee and immigration law, if any? I'm no, there are some. I wonder if some of the human rights internship might not be touching on that. We have some scholars specifically looking into human migrations, etc. So there are some. I can't. Oh, there is also a course. So I think we would probably be quite good comparatively in that field because of our research centers on the human rights and research center on human rights and legal pluralism. So obviously, it might lend itself to it. I can't give specific internships organizations right now, but that is something that can be looked at through the different lists of opportunities for students on our website. Otherwise, you can contact us and we can put you in touch with our pre-admission advisor from the program side. So we've gone past the hour and a half, so as you know, feel free to leave. I'll try to answer those, and then we'll wrap up the formal part and then not have too much time left for personal questions, but I'll stay behind a little bit. Les étudiants en transfert d'une autre faculté de droit font partie de quelle catégorie pour les admissions? Est-ce que les cours effectués dans l'autre université seront crédités? Donc, si c'est un programme de droit vraiment, de baccalauréat en droit qui mène à un diplôme de LLB ou l'équivalent qui vous permet de vous inscrire au barreau dans votre juridiction canadienne, donc au Québec ou en Ontario, là, vous êtes vraiment un étudiant en transfert. Ça, c'est une catégorie spécifique qui a une date limite beaucoup plus tard, c'est le 1er mai, parce qu'on veut avoir, évidemment, on veut voir comment vous avez réussi votre première année de droit à votre autre faculté. Et si vous êtes admis dans cette catégorie-là, oui, il peut y avoir jusqu'à 30 crédits qui vont vous être reconnus pour vos études antérieures. Ne sont pas éligibles en transfert les étudiants qui font leurs études de droit et qui sont en cours d'études de droit à l'extérieur du Canada, ou qui prennent des cours de droit dans des programmes qui ne sont pas des programmes de baccalauréat à temps plein qui mènent à un diplôme qui ouvre les portes du barreau. Le pourcentage demande-offre est à peu près similaire au reste, sinon un peu plus facile. On n'en reçoit pas tellement des demandes de transfert. Puis dans la classe, il peut y en avoir entre, disons, 2 et 5. C'est un chemin peut-être un peu sous-utilisé. Si quelqu'un fait une demande ici et est refusé, c'est peut-être une bonne chose d'aller commencer ailleurs. Vous allez peut-être tomber amoureux de votre autre faculté de droit, puis au moins vous aurez avancé votre processus, puis vous pouvez réessayer plus tard, puis vous joindre à la faculté après. Donc c'est vraiment une avenue qui est possible. Ah oui, OK. Pour ceux qui font la demande en ligne dans la catégorie universitaire, ils demandent les scores de SATs, en tout cas Il y a une partie où on peut mettre vraiment tous les genres de tests standardisés qu'on a fait. Ça, c'est parce qu'on fait partie de la demande. C'est la demande de McGill qui a ces champs-là. Donc, vous pouvez les mettre, on le voit. Si vous ne les mettez pas, ce n'est pas quelque chose que nous, on va détecter comme quelque chose qui manque. Le LSAT, oui, ça, c'est autre chose, là. Mais les autres tests, ils ne seront pas pris en considération. Le score ne sera pas pris en considération. Puis, de toute façon, il n'y aurait pas de preuves à l'appui de ce que vous dites qui était votre score. Donc, je pense que j'ai répondu. Bon, il y a quelqu'un qui est un gradué de McGill, il se demande pour le relever. Si vous êtes un gradué de McGill, on va l'avoir directement. Vous n'avez pas besoin de nous en envoyer une copie. OK. Should I mention the LSAT if I was registered but absent and didn't take it? Yes, yes. Because you have a LSAT history and we want to know. At the end of the day, we will get your report, the report from LSAC, and it will have the date and then I think it's a slash or a dash saying that indicates that there was a registration and no test. If you registered and canceled before taking the test, I'm not sure there's going to... I mean, you will have a record, but there might not even be a date. And you do have... I don't know if it's 24 hours or a little bit more. If you feel like you really didn't do well on the test or as well as you thought you would, you can cancel it ex post facto, and that will also indicate, you know, a marking that is kind of a neutral element for the committee. There's nothing really to infer from that. The deadline for reference letters is the same as for all the other documents. If my documents are translated into English, should I upload a copy of the originals as well as a translation, or is a translation enough? I imagine you're referring to transcripts, because reference letters, you wouldn't be uploading anything yourself. We would need to get the reference letters with their English or French official certified translation separately. I mean, the translator certifies that they got the original letter in a sealed and confidential way. That's usually the way it goes, and then the translator submits it in a confidential way. If it's a transcript, yes, we do need... I mean, we do have some committee members who speak German or Spanish, but no. So these documents need to have a translation. That being said, we're not afraid of international transcripts in the sense that we have all of our scales for all of the different countries. McGill has a lot of international transcript knowledge, so we will need a translation, but don't worry about the equivalency part of it. Yes. Yes. What's the criteria for admission for advanced standing applicants? It's the same. It's as competitive. You're being admitted into the program to get the degrees. We want to vet that you're of the same caliber as candidates in the other categories. There may be, like if you've been out of school for a long time, there may be an interview. But the criteria are the same in the sense, well, to be in that category, you would need a completed law degree that in your home jurisdiction leads to eligibility to pass the bar. So that's the criteria for that category. And that category would give you some advanced credits if you get admitted. But GPA, LSAT, personal statement, the standards would be the same. Okay. Is there any way to find out the calibration of my GPA from a 4.3 scale to a 4.0 scale before applying? I mean, we don't offer that service as an app or something that you can, you know, put your grades in and see what you would see at the end. I don't know that we can really answer that. Kelly, do you...
Can you go back to the formula for how
Okay, and where is that? Okay. Okay, so there is a way, I mean, McGill offers that, information is out there where you can, self-explore and try to do your own calculations, and it would be on mcgill.ca/study, which is kind of the new version of the phone book of everything about the programs and their, you know, so you would be able to find that there. Thank you, Kelly. Last one. Do your exchange grades get calculated into your GPA? So, does your exchange transcript have to be official? Like all other transcripts at the outset, no. So you can upload the version that you brought back from your host institution to your home institution. If you don't have that, your home institution would probably be able to provide you a copy of that. If you're admitted, then yes, everything official will need to be provided, and we will reconcile, make sure all the grades you said you had were the right grades. And it's true sometimes for exchange partners, it's like sometimes the administrative burden of ordering transcripts is quite high in some jurisdictions, so you might need to plan some time for that, like start early. Why not just start ordering it even if you're not admitted? I guess it's never lost. That was the last question. Thank you very much all for coming and all of you for staying. Please remember to give us your surveys on the way out. If there are questions we didn't answer and you've done your research and you can't find the answer, call us or email us or come to the counter. Merci beaucoup.